But what this information is doing, it's allowing us to understand the context of our health. You know, what are the predispositions and what can we do in our environment that offer meaningful impact?
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As a naturopathic doctor and anthropologist, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body, balance, and inner badass. These are the themes we are exploring. Well, today's episode was really fun because I had the opportunity to interview a friend of mine, Dr. Robin Murphy. And what we unpacked in this episode is really what I believe is going to be the new frontier of health and medicine. We've heard this term thrown around, this idea of precision medicine, this idea of individualized medicine. And when I first started my career, that meant that we listened to the individualized stories and symptoms and experiences of our patients. And from there, we're able to craft a unique approach to their health. Nowadays, this idea of individualized care and precision medicine means that we're able to look at the blueprint of your health, your actual DNA, to understand how we can craft something that not only incorporates your life stories, but enables us to address it in a manner we never thought possible. Robin Murphy is an expert at dissecting the intersection between genetics and lifestyle medicine, and it is truly my pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce you to her today so we can start to look at this concept and look directly at how it's going to apply to your health. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Robin Murphy. Dr. Robin Murphy, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast.
Hi, Megan. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
This is going to be such an exciting conversation and a little bit of a shift, because for the last few weeks, we've been doing lots of focus on mindset and some things that we need to do to move our business forward. And I'm really excited to jump back into some conversations with respect to health. And in doing so, we're going to talk about genetics today, and we're going to talk about the benefits of understanding a little bit more about our genetic blueprint. So before we do that, what I would love for you to do is just set the stage for our listeners in terms of your background and your experience and why you are so uniquely qualified to speak to this subject today.
Yeah, happy to. So my background is a naturopathic doctor, and I'm the scientific advisor for DNA Labs, which is a Toronto-based genetic company based out of Toronto, but they do lifestyle genetic testing as well as pharmacogenetic testing. And so right out of the bat, I would say, you know, right when I graduated, I was lucky enough to, get brought on to a company, another lifestyle genetics company, as the associate medical director. And that was just kind of a kismet, you know, experience where it allowed me to actually dive into the research of lifestyle genetics. I was responsible for training clinicians, for doing the research, for putting the panels together, and specifically for finding that clinical validation of how we take this information, how we apply it clinically, and what are the measurements and outcome that we can get for meaningful results. So I've been doing that for the past 7 years now. And that's just led to these different platforms where, you know, I get to train physicians, I get to speak a lot about it. And it takes up a lot of my time, but it's a nice balance to clinic life.
So before we get into what actual lifestyle genetics is, can you just speak to a little bit the history of genetics and how it's been used in medicine, really, we'll say, over the last sort of 10 to 15 years in a traditional sense?
Yeah, so probably about 2 decades ago, this is when the Human Genome Project was launched and actually completed. And this was a $1 billion investment, so the most expensive genetic test that we have to date. And what the scientists were expecting to understand is that every single protein in our body had a gene. So it was, you know, one gene equals one protein, and we're going to figure out how the entire, you know, human physiology works. But what they discovered is that there was only about 22,000 genes rather than 64,000 proteins. And what this, created is just this explosion of research looking at, you know, how our genes, not only the genetic code, but also our epigenetics plays into our overall health and wellness. And from a traditional standpoint, most people may have come across genetic testing, perhaps in a hospital for disease-based genes. So things like could be even celiac disease or macular degeneration or maybe ALS. A lot of times you'll see it in fertility. So they'll look at chromosomal errors just to make sure the baby's healthy, or paternity testing, you know, is quite common. You see a lot of old Jerry Springer and those types of shows using paternity testing and is he the father type of thing. So I think that's where people have become familiar with it. And then just in the last, I would say, you know, maybe 10 years, we've started to see other applications of genetics, which is more kind of lifestyle genetics or nutrigenomics. And this is where we're uncovering all this research and understanding about how our genes interact with our environment. It's helping us to really dive into that, you know, precision medicine of trying to understand our unique biochemical makeup and how we can alter our environment to then alter the expression of the genes as well as development of disease.
Okay, and so give us some context on this, because I want to enter this conversation without anyone having assumptions. And one of the things, as a clinician who has been frankly using genetic testing for a number of years in a variety of different capacities, is that one of the conversations I realized I had to have with people up front was, your genes do not determine your outcome. And I think a lot of people are and I want to really kind of understand its value given that statement, and we'll give some context to it. Because I think a lot of people, if they come in, they're like, please just tell me my genes say that my thyroid will never work and that's why I keep gaining weight. Or please just tell me my genes explain away X, Y, and Z. And I speak to one's genetic blueprint and why we want to have an understanding of some of these key markers, as it's sort of like doing a renovation on your home, which is how I really view the work that I do as a naturopathic doctor. And what we have finally found is the original blueprint. So we actually know what's behind the walls. We have a sense of what we are working with, but that original blueprint does not necessarily determine how beautiful your house is going to be, or how healthy your house is going to be, or where you're going to put the final wall. So I would love for you to just give people some context in terms of, you know, we're going to speak to genetic testing, but it doesn't necessarily mean all of these pieces are absolute.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very good point, because I think a lot of people, you know, there's a dichotomy of individuals approaching this where some come at it with a lot of fear. Maybe there's a family history of, say, Alzheimer's. And, you know, to be honest, that was my experience, is my Nana was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. When I first got into the field of genetics, I was a little bit apprehensive about getting my genes tested and then finding out what if I carried the gene for Alzheimer's. And even, you know, being in the field, I understand that fear. And so what's really fascinating about this information is your genes, like you said, Megan, is not the end all be all. These are our blueprints. So it's kind of like our instructions and information that our cells are using of how to interact within the environment. But it's the environment within itself which is going to dictate how these genes and potential diseases get expressed. So say, for example, a lot of people have come across the gene called BRCA1. I think it was made most popular by Angelina Jolie when she did the test, and it showed that she was a carrier for BRCA1, and this elevates a woman's risk for cancer significantly. You know, there's a 40% chance of breast cancer. And so she made the decision to do a double mastectomy. And, you know, that's a big choice. But the way that I look at this is, you know, could there have been another approach. We know that, yes, 40% of women do go on to develop cancer, but 60% don't. And when we start to look at some of the other pathways that are related to estrogen, related to protecting our DNA, there has been discoveries that show how certain environmental choices that people make will actually impact how women express this gene. So for example, there's a certain gene called our cytochrome 1A2. These are our liver enzymes. They kind of break down everything from hormones to caffeine to even toxins that we're exposed to. And this pathway, there was an interesting study that showed women who did not consume, who had a version of this gene that were quote unquote slow. So they had a harder time metabolizing, say, caffeine, but also estrogen. So their body would naturally have higher estrogen levels. If they consumed 1 to 2 cups of coffee a day in their lifetime compared to women who consume no coffee, they actually had a 64% reduction in breast cancer if they were a carrier of BRCA1. And that's just a simple environmental change of drinking coffee, which I think everyone can do. So what this information, that's just one example, but what this information is doing, it's allowing us to understand the context of our health. You know, what are the predispositions and what can we do in our environment that offer meaningful impact?
Yeah, and I've often shared with my patients that when we're talking about lifestyle genetics, we really are almost intentionally looking at those genetic markers that empower us to make change. And have research around that change, as opposed to genetic markers that are going to sort of predetermine your fate. So no one is walking into these tests about to learn something that is, you know, an unchangeable destiny. All of the markers that we're talking about, we're handing them to you because it actually enables you to take control of your fate. It's like the ultimate radical responsibility with respect to your health.
Yeah, exactly. And this is kind of the seed of precision medicine. When we talk about kind of personalized medicine, it's about being predictive and being precise, as well as having the patient participate in the decisions which empower them to change their health.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this idea of lifestyle genetics. What are some of the categories of markers that are most commonly examined?
Yeah, so, you know, we always look at kind of sensitivities and intolerances. So are you sensitive to caffeine? If you are, then you tend to, there can be an increased risk of, say, non-fatal heart attack if you're drinking too much. Are you sensitive to gluten or lactose? We can understand this from our genes. We can also look at what is your specific nutrient needs? Not everybody is able to efficiently extract nutrients, vitamins, minerals, and transport them, you know, from the food and the digestive tract into our cells. So what are the specific dosages and types of formulas and nutrients that you require? We also look at some of dietary implications. So, you know, are you a candidate for keto? I know that's, you know, these fad diets come out and a lot of people, you know, jump on the bandwagon, but we really don't know how your body's going to respond until we get some objective data like our genetics. So looking at dietary regimes, even exercise regimes, I'm just kind of diving into that literature and research with my own hobbies that I'm developing. And then mental wellness is a big one, especially in these day and age, in this day and age right now. What we're seeing with susceptibility to depression, anxiety, especially with isolation, we can start to understand a little bit about our predispositions, even how we're perhaps sensitive to stress and a negative bias, you know, looking at particular situations in a certain way and how that can lead to, say, depression or anxiety. There's a lot, you know, detoxification, cardiovascular disease, obesity risk, you know, the list just keeps getting longer as, you know, research comes out.
Well, and I think it really then underscores why it's so helpful to be able to work with a strategist to help you dissect this information. And so, again, I want to give context to this because I think what a lot of people have done is they've like, they're like, oh, this is really cool, but I've done 23andMe and I got three or four markers, and they're running with it. They're running with it themselves. And so, you know, when we start to talk about this idea of precision medicine, can you just take us through clinically, like how you leverage this data as a clinician, and then build out a unique lifestyle prescription or series of suggestions for patients? And then we're going to jump back to mental wellness.
Mm-hmm. Well, with any sort of objective data or functional medicine testing, you know, this is a piece of the puzzle. So we're utilizing this data in addition to obviously past medical history, physical exams, necessary labs, just regular blood work. And what this gives us is an initial picture and baseline to see what is the status of your health, as well as how are these genes getting expressed. So, what I find with how the, you know, genetics and these lifestyle panels intersect with naturopathic medicine or integrative medicine, it actually aligns really well to our strategy, or, you know, the therapeutic order, which is known in naturopathic medicine. So, you know, we start by removing the obstacles. So we would focus on looking at, are you, you know, do you have any sensitivities? Do you have any increased risk to the effects of toxins? Can we remove that first? And then go into stimulating the body's own ability to heal, you know, through diet that's appropriate based on your genetics, through nutritional replenishment, and then strength and weaken systems. So getting into supporting our detox pathways, our methylation, our hormones, and then the last two areas, you know, correcting structural integrity, as well as restore and regenerate, are starting to get into some of those other pathways from a genetic standpoint that are focusing on kind of the mitochondria, the energy production faculties within our cells, and antioxidant pathways, which are really essential for protecting our DNA, as well as contributing to the aging process. So from a clinician's standpoint, you know, it helps us to kind of guide the patient through a stepwise protocol so that we're focusing on each level, using objective data to help guide us, as well as additional labs. From a business standpoint, I think it's also really smart because we know that when people are doing certain tests, they tend to commit more if it's based on, you know, unique data that's from them. You know, in genetic testing, there has been reports showing that when people are prescribed a certain diet that's based on their genes, they're more likely to adhere to that for a year, you know, post prescription.
And when we're talking about a diet or lifestyle that's based on one's genes, and we're trying to modify things, we'll talk about epigenetics in a second. Does that mean that someone has to stay on a diet or on a supplementation protocol forever? Like, are we able to change the outcome, or is it kind of like, here's your new protocol for life?
It's such a good point, because, you know, we have to think of this like the body is dynamic. We're not in this, you know, cryo chamber where when we implement a certain treatment or we're trying to facilitate or compensate for certain genetic alterations, when we provide a treatment, it's not the end all be all. There are things in our environment as we age, maybe stressors in our life, maybe changes in our dietary regime, that will shift our focus of how we're implementing these. So there is no, you know, one protocol for the rest of your life. It's more guidance as to, depending on what your goals are, what you're dealing with, you know, and that's where working with a practitioner is really adventitious, because then you can start to identify, okay, what are we working on now? What do we need to address? And then how are we surveilling this? You know, what are the parameters that we're using to show how our treatments are having an effect and what these genes are doing? So say, for example, iron. You know, some people have an increased risk for anemia, and it's because they can't transport the iron as effectively to the cells. So if they're eating a diet that's rich in iron, great, they don't need any supplementation. But say they, you know, switch to a vegetarian diet, or say they have an infection, and that's, you know, reducing their consumption as well as, you know, reducing their absorption. Well, that's when I'm going to, you know, go in and treat It's according to their genes, but it's, you know, also according to their lifestyle and the current environment.
Yeah, well, and I really like this. I like where this conversation is going, and I feel like it lends us really perfectly to sort of open the subject matter around this concept of epigenetics. And this is one of the areas that I've certainly found for myself as a clinician most exciting when it came to discussing genetics. It was the part that I found patients were most empowered by when it came to discussing genetics. Can you just open the door to what epigenetics is all about? Because I think this is really part of the frontier of handing control back to patients through this process.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's kind of interesting because the term itself, I feel, has changed and kind of taken on its own meaning from a public standpoint. So I'll just kind of, you know, set the stage and define what the medical terminology is talking about. So epigenetics refers to actual chemical tags, which are put onto the DNA itself. And these chemical tags are in response to the environment so that the cell is essentially learning from the environment to say, okay, I need to turn on this one particular gene more so, or I need to turn off this gene. So say, for example, there's a study done out of from the Dutch famine. So this is 1944 to 1945. And women who were pregnant during that time, due to epigenetic changes, the babies that were born from that era were shorter as well as heavier. And so their epigenetic imprints that were being passed on from their mother was to help to improve the survivability of the baby. And whether or not that's appropriate or not, you know, these kids went on to actually have an increased risk of metabolic disease because, you know, their bodies were acquiring this knowledge around an environment that included starvation. And so that's an example of kind of epigenetics. And these can be transgenerational. And so typically these are long-term changes that occur. On the other side of it, from a public-facing perspective, I've heard the term epigenetics referring to how we turn on and off our genes, not necessarily from a long-term chemical standpoint, but just the changes in our environment, how those will impact gene expression. And sometimes it can be long-term. And there's actually companies that are doing epigenetic testing. So it's still cost prohibitive, I would say, but they are starting to show how certain patterns within the epigenetics can get changed by, say, meditation. And so now these are measurable effects on our DNA. In addition to understanding our genetic blueprint, now we can see, okay, what are these lifestyle changes that we're implementing, how are they actually changing the expression of these genes? And the reason it's so empowering is because when you know that, say, for example, there's a serotonin receptor, some people have a very high sensitivity to stress, it increases their cortisol levels and can increase risk for, say, depression with certain life stressors. If I know this and I'm implementing meditation, you know, every day for a year, there'll be it shows that the epigenetics of that gene gets downregulated, meaning that my body is kind of silencing the effect that that gene is having or that variation. Therefore, I'm kind of overcoming my genetic predispositions. And this is how it's so empowering and how I think the public is really referring to epigenetic changes.
Yeah, and I think this is so, I'm sitting here smiling as you're talking about it because I do think this is so exciting. And this is where, you know, we're handing so much control back to people because you can take a drug or frankly you can take a supplement for the rest of your life that can sort of pound a pathway into behaving a certain way, or we can actually start to engage in a lifestyle that fully changes the expression of these genes. And you know, I think our microbiome is an example of that. You mentioned meditation as being an example of that. Eating whole real foods, I think, can be another example of these opportunities to change that epigenetic expression. This is where I think the bulk of research is going to be so exciting for the average person in terms of being able to control their genetic and health destiny with a little bit more precision. And you mentioned mentioned in there, Robin, this idea of mental health and stress sensitivity and serotonin. I'd love for you to just unpack this a little bit more, because I do find, and you know, even in conversations on this podcast, I feel like so much of mental health has historically been people's opinions. And so, yeah. You know, anxiety is real. Anxiety is not real. Depression is real. It's a mindset. It's like we, this is really a frontier of health where I have found that we have very little objective data. There's suggestions that it's related to serotonin levels, but then that's not the majority of the case. And so I actually feel like we've done a really poor job and have had really poor access to the science that helps to explain what's happening from a mental health perspective or a psychological manifestation. So I'd love for you to just speak to some of the research around the genetic understanding, because I think it puts so much context on this subject matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of the research, they'll do population studies or they'll do, you know, they'll look at certain specific groups of individuals with, say, depression. And then they'll start with a genome-wide study. So they'll kind of do a whole entire genetic analysis and try and find what are the similarities between these individuals in the genes and the certain versions of those genes. And then they'll start to narrow down what are the pathways that these genes and these enzymes related to, and do they have a physiological effect, and does it help to explain, you know, the presentation of this? This is kind of how researchers disseminate and narrow down certain clinically beneficial and effective genes. So when we look at, say, risk for depression, one of the major pathways is the dopaminergic pathway. So dopamine, you know, it's our motivation, our reward, our drive. And some of the theories around kind of neurotransmitter levels with depression have to do with the availability of dopamine within the brain, and kind of this concept of neurotransmitter deficiencies. And it's much more complicated than that. But what we do find, and what they've been able to identify, is that certain genes in an enzyme called COMT, so catechol-O-methyltransferase, this is responsible for breaking down dopamine. So once our body, you know, we do something exciting, whether it's, you know, speaking to Megan on a podcast, or, you know, presenting to a group of individuals, or even having, you know, a really sweet donut or something, that will elicit dopamine. But the availability of dopamine has to do with how quickly we either break it down, or it, you know, the opportunity that it has to bind to the receptor to actually elicit that response. So individuals who have a really fast and efficient enzyme, they tend to have lower prefrontal dopamine levels. So this is actually measurable, and they can see and measure the kinetics of this enzyme. So it starts to give us a little bit of understanding about, okay, now these physiological components do have an impact on depression. And what they find is with these individuals with kind of this fast version, they have lower prefrontal dopamine levels. This can increase their risk for early onset depression. It can also predict if they're going to be, you know, respond better to certain types of antidepressants. And from a positive side, just from kind of understanding our own personality and how we respond to the environment, there's studies looking at, these are the individuals which are called the warriors. They can get into stressful situations, and they actually respond better under stress when they're looking at cognitive performance parameters, where their alternative, the individuals who have a slower enzyme function, what happens is kind of when we look at dopamine and the benefits of it, it's in a U sort of shape. So low dopamine levels, probably not the best. We're not getting that drive and motivation. And then the dopamine levels will increase. We get, you know, super elated, we get that internal reward, we're excited, we're passionate, but then it reaches a threshold. So if, you know, these individuals, if they're in a scenario where the stress keeps building, they'll get to a point where that dopamine now becomes almost irritative to the brain. And that's where you'll see more anxiety more, you know, the effects of stress, the higher cortisol, and they actually don't perform as better. So as, you know, business owners or entrepreneurs or anyone trying to understand, you know, how to kind of maximize, you know, their return, I guess, in a scenario, what's really interesting about behavioral genetics is it can kind of give us these hints and understanding to how we're wired and then what we can do to kind of compensate for that.
And have you found in working with patients and in having and in working with clinicians who are working with patients, what kind of influence is this having in terms of a traditionally pharmacological approach to managing anxiety or depression? Because, you know, I think we can all agree, on no matter what side of medicine you're practicing, that the research around the efficacy of antidepressants is not as strong as television commercials would lead us to believe. So I'm actually really interested to see from your perspective how this actually plays out clinically for patients.
Yeah. So first of all, you know, this is called a this sector is called pharmacogenomics. So they're looking at how certain drugs are being broken down. You know, what is the speed and efficiency, and can we predict a risk for side effects or a lack of response? And when I say lack of response, it's typically because the dose isn't high enough to provide the therapeutic level that is necessary to see how this drug is having an effect. And with doctors, you know, when you see patients on antidepressants, the difficulty is knowing whether or not the reactions that they're having is because it's a continuation of their symptoms, because the dose is too low, or they're having side effects to that drug. And so there's, you know, certain strategies, and it's kind of like just try drug one. If that doesn't work, you know, that's 4 to 6 weeks that you're trying an initial drug. And then there's a washout period. And then, okay, that didn't work. You know, drug two, and then drug three, and drug four. And sometimes I've seen with patients, it's 2 years before they find the appropriate drug and appropriate regime where they're finding balance in their mental health. And so when we look at the efficacy and response, it's about 50 to 60% for individuals, you know, in the likelihood that they're going to respond to a certain drug, which isn't, you know, placebo studies tend to be comparable to that. So with pharmacogenomics, and, you know, one patient that sticks out is a woman. She had bipolar disorder. She had been admitted into CAMH. She was just, you know, and she's a professional. She, I believe she comes from a background of research, and I can't remember exactly what it was. But anyway, she just found that what the report did is it validated her experience. So she understood, you know, why it was so difficult for her to find the appropriate regime. But she also took that information to her psychiatrist and was able to work with that doctor to then kind of choose a drug that maybe wouldn't be so likely to have side effects. And she was able to find an appropriate drug to help stabilize her.
And this is so exciting. And the part that's so exciting to me is that it's actually only going to get better. It's only going to get more common. The cost of being able to access this type of information and testing is only going to decrease. I think we're just in we're in the infancy of how this is going to be applied to an individual's health. Robin, can you just share with us a little bit about what this looks like from a practical perspective? Like, how are we actually acquiring the genetic material that is used for testing?
Sure. And I just want to follow up with a little comment regarding the mental health piece and the pharmacogenomics is, you know, this is going to be implemented, I believe, on a conventional standpoint across the board, because CAMH just finished a 5-year study using pharmacogenomics to see if they can help physicians in their prescribing regimens. And it's just, you know, more and more it's being adapted even in hospitals now. Sick Kids Hospital, they're utilizing pharmacogenomics for, I believe, pediatrics and oncology. So We are going to be seeing this implemented more regularly. When it comes to the actual practical, sampling of the genetics, it's just a cheek swab. So no eating, no drinking 30 minutes beforehand. You just swab the inner lining of your cheek. You're getting buccal cells, and that will contain all your DNA. Our DNA is the same in every single cell of our body, euploid cells. And then you put it in a stabilizing solution and send it to the lab. So the facility that I work with, we're here in Toronto, and the lab is in the States. So some people have some concerns about, the information and where that goes, and, if it goes into cyberspace, whether or not, their information is protected. And there are privacy laws that have been in place in Canada and the U.S. as well. So this prevents discrimination. It's called GINA, is the bill that was passed, and it prevents discrimination from employers as well as insurance companies of utilizing this information. And then what companies will do is they'll de-identify the samples. So it'll just be a number or a barcode that represents your sample, so that it is protected.
Yeah, I think that's a really important piece. And I think most people actually don't know to ask that in terms of how one's privacy is protected throughout this process. And Robin, if people want to actually have the test done, what does that look like? How do they have to order it themselves, or do they work through a clinician? What's your recommendation around that?
Yeah, well, it's exciting now because now these tests are available direct to consumers. So individuals can access it directly on our website, www.dnalabs.ca or .com if you're in the States. If it's through a clinician, we do have clinician-specific panels as well. So there's a pro panel, and this contains some information around cardiovascular health, including neurological health and risk for those diseases, where we believe that it's very important for people to have that information delivered in the setting of a clinic. With a clinician, so that they understand, like we were talking about before, that just because this certain gene is present doesn't mean you're going to get this disease, right? So clinicians can set up an account, and then they can have the kits actually in-house, or they can send their patients kind of to the website, and there'll be, a link that they can send them to, so that they can get the results in-house and discuss that with their patients during their visit.
Yeah, and what we're going to do is we'll hook all of our listeners up with links so that they can learn a little bit more about this this process. And for our clinicians in the crowd, and here's the thing, and I just want to speak to what Robin just said. A clinician's going to be able to offer you some new and interesting perspectives. This is not easy stuff. This is not easy stuff because it's not a matter of you get your panel and it tells you all the things that are turned on for you and what to take. It really isn't that simple. We are all so unique. There are so many confounding factors that go into this piece. And so, speaking myself as a clinician, genetic testing is something I did a lot of in my own practice. And the learning curve for that was steep. And I was highly reliant, frankly, on you and your colleagues to make sure that I was sufficiently informed as I was working with patients on this piece. And so for that, and to that point, one of the things that we're going to do, Robin and I together, she's talking genetics, I'm going to talk about how we work with patients around these pieces. We're going to offer a masterclass. And it's for clinicians, and we're going to be doing it in September, but you can access it in our show notes, or you can access and sign up for it by going to clinicianbusinesslabs.com/genetics. And that will be taking place in September. And we're going to do a combination of clinician education as well as looking at how we implement this and communicate these pieces to patients. So tons of resources in our show notes for people to learn a little bit more about the genetic piece, because it really does require some learning, but it's super exciting.
Mm-hmm. And I just, that was one of the biggest changes that I made with the current company that I'm with, is previously, you know, the lab that I was working with, when you and I were working together, the report was really for a geneticist and it was for a researcher and it was very dense and it took a lot of interpretation. But, you know, the company, DNA Labs that I'm working with, they've really changed how the reporting is so that you don't necessarily need to know all the genetics and all the specifics, you know, regarding the genes. You just need to understand the outcome. And as a clinician, it's just, you know, do you have an increased risk for, say, Alzheimer's? Does that, you know, do you have an increased risk for diabetes? Yeah, and you do look at these individual pathways, you know, and how they relate, but that's what you do as a clinician anyways. So it is pulling from already existing knowledge. The learning curve, you know, is still there, but it's definitely, you don't need to learn 23,000 genes and all of their, you know, biochemical nuances. It's more the practical application now that we're focusing on. So I don't think it should be daunting to clinicians. I think this is really exciting and it can really, you know, put you ahead of the curve and in line with where medicine is going.
I couldn't agree more. As an ND and anthropologist, I have always been on the lookout for unique insights into my own health. While I have gadgets and trackers, nothing has provided me with the kind of actionable information I needed, like lifestyle genetic testing. DNA Labs is a lifestyle genetics testing company based in Toronto, Canada. Lifestyle genetics offers insight into the relationship between your genes and the lifestyle choices you have access to every day. The frontier of health is precision medicine. Informing yourself and your practitioner about your genetic blueprint provides personalized insight unattainable through any other sort of testing. Whether it is understanding how to reduce your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, or depression, selecting the most efficacious medications, or reducing side effects to those medications, or even designing a lifestyle plan and health optimization protocol that harnesses your unique potential, this is the mission of DNA Labs. Acquiring samples are as simple as a cheek swab and can be completed in the privacy of your own home. For public listeners in Canada and the U.S., until July 30th, you can receive a 15% discount for online orders when you enter anthropology2020 at dnalabs.ca. For practitioners, you can access a pro panel and practitioner pricing by sending a message to contact@dnalabs.ca.
Robin, I feel like this is a perfect place to make a transition in the interview. And the last component is something I call our KPI component or key performance indicators. So just like we have them in our business, I believe we have them in how we live our life as well. So I've got some rapid fire questions for you.
All right, let's go.
All right, let's see where your brain is at. I wonder if we can predict people's rapid fire speed based on their genetics. Okay, first question for you. What's the most impactful book or piece of reading that you have come across during the pandemic?
I've actually been reading Robin Williams' biography. And for me, it's just looking at his life, you know, that he struggled with depression from very early on. And there are kind of those key indicators. To me, actually, you know, I'm used to reading a lot of science-based books. And this was actually really nice to just take a break and, you know, learn about him as an individual.
What's the one thing you're most consistent with respect to your health?
That's a tough one because, okay, this is a good answer because I'm consistent with referring to my genetic report. No matter what I'm doing.
Of course you are.
Yeah, no matter what I'm doing, whether it's like right now I'm into cycling, so I've been researching and getting into and referring back to my genetic report to look at my exercise physiology and, you know, how my body is geared towards that. And I've been pretty consistent with doing that, but I'm always trying different protocols and, you know, different. I'm a big guinea pig, essentially.
What's something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
Well, right now I am demoing a house and rebuilding it. So I think that's pretty badass. It's a steep learning curve and I'm pretty good with my hands.
That's awesome. What do you do for fun or play?
Right now it's cycling. I'm just putting together kind of a long distance road cycling, group, and we're actually going to raise money for COVID relief.
I love that. Okay, follow up with me on that piece because I love to cycle too. And last question for you, Robin, and I feel like this is going to be so interesting given our discussion. Entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
Oh, that's a good one. I definitely think it's in our blood. I think there's a heritability and, you know, something that's just in us and to have that drive. But this is the question of nature versus nurture. I do think that the genetics is there, and whether or not the environment nurtures that will then depict, you know, what road you go down.
I love it. Dr. Robin Murphy, you are up to so many things. Where can we send people to learn a little bit more about you and the work you're doing with DNA Labs?
Yeah, I'd love for you guys to connect with me on my website, www.drrobinmurphy.com, or you can reach me through my email, info@drrobinmurphy.com.
Amazing. Robin, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Megan. This is so much fun. I really appreciate your time, and I think this is great for the listeners.
The Anthropology Podcast is about leveling up your mindset, your health, and your business so you can maximize your impact in this world. To that end, we're going to begin with a new series of offerings to help you have that impact you've always dreamed of. Over on the Anthropology Podcast page, we're going to start doing live broadcasts of episodes. Sometimes these will be solo episodes, and sometimes these will be with guests. This is your opportunity to interact with us live as we are recording your favorite episodes. Adjacent to our Facebook page, we also have the Anthropology Collective, a free Facebook group with hundreds of fellow entrepreneurs just like you. In the Anthropology Collective, we're going to keep you up to date on upcoming masterclasses, interact daily, as well as have new offerings like our Badass Book Club. After a two-year hiatus, we are bringing it back. Our new April and May selections are going to be announced in the coming weeks, and we would love for you to participate in all of these new virtual offerings. I believe that when people have their health, they can change the world. That is what inspired us to start this podcast in the first place. And that is what is inspiring us to keep going. I'm so appreciative of all of you. Give us a like over on Apple iTunes and come and join us in the collective. We'll see you there.